From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Blasphemy, an insult to the sacred, has a long, rough history. The last person executed for blasphemy in Britain was Thomas Aikenhead in 1697 for calling Jesus an imposter. In the Islamic world, the punishment, killing, goes on. In Saudi Arabia, a critic of the regime sentenced to 1,000 lashes for blasphemy, 50 lashes a week for 20 weeks. He got his first 50 lashes last Friday. There's execution, too. The charge is religious, but it's loaded with politics. And then there is the massacre in Paris. This hour on Point, the Islamic world and blasphemy. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Why is the blasphemy charge hot in and out of the Islamic world in 2015? Muslim listeners, what do you see, and how does all this square with the idea of free speech? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. This is not a very, very simple subject. The Pope, looking at it from a Christian angle for today in the Philippines, said one cannot make fun of faith. Head of the Catholic Church saying that. On the other hand, we've got whippings and lashings and beatings and burnings and execution, and in the case of Paris, massacre in the last week. Joining me first today from Washington is Mustafa Akyol. He is a columnist for Turkey's Star and Hurriyet Daily News, monthly columnist for the New York Times, author of Islam Without Extremes, A Muslim Case for Liberty. His column, Islam's Problem with Blasphemy, appeared in yesterday's New York Times. You can find a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Mustafa Akyol, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom, for having me on the show. It's my pleasure.
There's a lot to look at here. There's a lot going on. Many people see this as being used as a political tool by authoritarian regimes inside the Islamic world. Now it's reaching outside as well. What does the Quran say about blasphemy?
Well, I try to explain that in my column in the New York Times the other day, and also in my book. There's a chapter about this titled Freedom from Islam. Interestingly, the Quran doesn't have any earthly punishment for blasphemy. Or apostasy, too, for
that is leaving the religion.
Mm-hmm. That's leaving the religion. But you have those punishments in the Sharia, which is the Islamic law devised by Muslim scholars in the Middle Ages, which is rooted in some concepts of the Quran, but it's much more detailed than that. If you look at the Quran, to go back to that, actually, there's in the whole Quran, there is one verse that really addresses the issue of Islam being mocked by non-Muslims. And it says, if you hear a group of people mocking God's verses, then do not sit with those people unless they engage in a different discourse.
That's so it basically says walk away. If you hear something
walk away.
Mocking,
I mean, if that's something disrespectful to your faith, refuse to join it. I mean, because that's really offensive. But you just boycott that by saying, okay, I'm not going to talk with you because you're rude people, basically.
And in so all the Quran, that's the only thing it says about when the religion is mocked or insulted?
Yes, that's relating to mockery. There are a few other verses. Again, it says you will hear some mockery and you will hear some hurting words by non-Muslims, and just it says, say that we believe in what we believe, you believe in what you believe. So there's no verse which says go and kill and attack. There are some verses in the Quran about violence, and it says like go and attack those people, and sometimes people misquote those verses. But those verses reflect battle situations where Muslims are in a war zone with the army, because in the early Muslim community was in a war with pagans who attacked them first. So there are some verses about, in that case, violent in that sense. But regarding the blasphemy, regarding the makri of fate or blasphemy, the Quran really doesn't give any earthly punishment. Evolved later in the first centuries of Islam as Islamic empires needed an extensive law and Sharia was devised for that. But it is not, if you ask me, that's not really God-given.
Well, look
it's
at that.
Man-made.
I mean, in fairness, we should say in the Bible, in the Old Testament, the Leviticus 24:16, anyone who blasphemes in the name of the Lord is to be put to death. The entire assembly must stone them. That's from the Bible, not from the Quran, not from Islam. So this kind of language shows up. But let me ask you about this, because, I mean, there's so much attitude out there that seems to lean the other way. And I'm reading here, this is in USA Today, just a few days ago. This was written by Anjum Chowdhury. This is a Muslim cleric in London, lecturer in Sharia. But he says, the messenger Muhammad said, quote, whoever insults a prophet, kill him. Is that false? Is that not
Well, okay, that brings us to the second source of Islam, the hadiths, the sayings of Prophet Muhammad. And, well, that is true in the sense that there is a quote like that in Islamic literature. That's not coming from the Quran, which is the most sacred source of Islam. That is coming from the hadiths or sayings, which are words attributed to Prophet Muhammad. And yes, there's a whole literature of hadiths. And a lot of the authoritarian aspects of Sharia, including stoning, killing of Basis, comes from the hadiths. But mind you, Tom, there's a key thing there. Mm-hmm. The hadiths were written about 2 centuries after the Prophet. It was an oral tradition. And a lot of the hadiths, now scholars accept that were made up after the facts, just imagined or just they were legends. So hadiths are disputable, and more reformist-minded Muslims, including myself, are saying, let's just look at this hadith literature, and maybe they really do not reflect. Let's just look at the Quran, which is the undisputable source in this case, which was written down from the first years of Islam without any dispute. So there are some verses like that, and there's another story of a poet that was mocking Prophet Muhammad was being killed in Medina. But again, there is a dispute there whether he was killed because he was mocking the Prophet or he was engaged in an assassination plot against the Prophet. These are different narratives, but none of them are as authoritative as the Quran. So people like me are saying, well, let's take what the Quran says, first of all. These are narratives. Part of them are legends written 2 centuries after the Prophet, and we can learn from them, the hadiths, but we cannot take them as sacrosanct.
Why is there then so much in the Islamic world? Never mind for a moment this, you know, this has reached out into Paris and France. We saw it earlier elsewhere in Europe. But in the Islamic world, I mean, you just look anywhere online and you see all these stories about people being punished, people being lashed. The guy in Saudi Arabia had his first 50 out of 1,000 lashes last Friday. I'm reading here that he may not survive before he gets to 1,000. In Mauritania, this is in West Africa. A political critic of the government there sentenced to death by firing squad, and the blasphemy or insult to the sacred is the charge there. In Pakistan, lots and lots of cases. If this is in any way peripheral, why is it being applied so widely first inside the Islamic world?
Well, I'm not saying it's peripheral. It's a fundamental problem, and that's why my New York Times article says Islam's blasphemy problem. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that we Muslims should move away from this. Blasphemy was, as you said, was banned and severely punished in medieval Christianity as well, but Christians moved beyond that. It doesn't mean that we will enjoy blasphemy or we will enjoy the cartoons of Prophet Muhammad. We can find them offensive. I do find them offensive, but I'm not going to kill people. I will just say you're rude and I don't approve what you do. I will not buy your newspaper anymore. The thing is, I think the main problem here, Tom, is that Islam has been used by states from the very beginning for their own purposes. Islamic law, Sharia, evolved actually when despotic empires in the Muslim world needed a legal system, and scholars developed Sharia, and a lot of injunctions came which actually protected the authorities. And this still goes on. I mean, Saudi Arabia punishes people for so-called blasphemy. Sometimes you look at it, it's just a critique of the Saudi regime. And the actually evolution of the blasphemy punishments were actually like that, as I pointed out in my piece. One of the first so-called blasphemers in the Muslim world that was killed in the middle of the 8th century, he was Gaylan al-Dumakshi, a scholar who criticized the Umayyad Sultan for being despotic. Mm-hmm. And he was killed for blasphemy. So states needed to get rid of their opponents. That's why this blasphemy and apostasy accusations served them as they still serve today. But the argument that I make and other more reformist-minded Muslims make is that we should be able to detach the core values of our religion from this historical baggage that it has, from medieval interpretations that reflected the values of that time or maybe served the political interests of that time.
It may be authoritarian regimes using this or more up-to-date the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian
Peninsula.
Oh, that's
the most extreme example.
I mean, we'll look at that. But it seems to have... This severe offense at this, the taking severe offense, seems to have filtered well down into many parts of the population here. Here are three voices. This is from Paris, Muslim neighborhoods, talking with NBC News yesterday, saying that showing the Prophet Muhammad is provocative. They go all the way to civil war.
See, provocation. There's more provocation.
Why are you talking about my prophet?
It's not your religion. Why are you talking about this guy?
I think it will bring a civil war.
You think a civil war is possible?
A civil war is coming, yes.
And this over the cover of Charlie Hebdo, or covers over time. Of course, Charlie Hebdo has put Jesus on the cover. It's put Muslims and Jews and Christians and more on the cover. Is the depiction of the Prophet Muhammad in itself an offense? Is that come under, is it an offense under the Quran, Mustafa?
Well, there are two things here. Just any image of Prophet Muhammad is seen as problematic, plus a cartoon that really ridicules him is, an additional thing. Where does this come from, any depiction of Prophet Muhammad being problematic? Well, the Quran, again, doesn't say anything about that. The Quran doesn't say you can't draw pictures of the prophets. But it comes from an understanding in early Islam. Muslims were worried that they would look like the pagans who worshipped idols and engraved images. So it was banned to make the image of Prophet or his companions, fearing that this could look like paganism or like idolatry.
Well, for that matter, any figure, anything of the human figure in some eras, in some places, and right? Look at the Taj Mahal, indeed, all this beautiful stuff, but no human figures.
Indeed, no animal or human figures, because Muslims were worried that they would look like the pagans. So they just preferred geographical shapes and so on and so forth. And actually, Orthodox Judaism has a similar attitude towards paintings. Now, my argument to that is that, yes, I understand that, but today in the modern world, people don't worship photographs or paintings. I mean, that was a time we could be a little bit more relaxed on that issue.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Islam, the Islamic world, and blasphemy, beatings in Pakistan and more, flogging in Saudi Arabia, death by firing squad in Mauritania, death a dozen and more in Paris at Charlie Hebdo and beyond. You can join the conversation this hour. Muslim listeners, my guest today, Mustafa Akyol, and we'll hear from more in just a moment, says it's not in the Quran. So why? Is it a medieval leftover? Is it a response to Western challenges? Is it a tool of authoritarian control inside the Islamic world? And then, as of today, in the Philippines, the Pope says one cannot make fun of faith, but killing over perceived insults, flogging? How do we work with this, deal with this, explain this, and just how much is punished along these lines within the Islamic world? Here's a man in the streets of Cairo responding, talking with Agence France-Presse. He says, free speech, too much here.
Freedom of speech doesn't mean that I have the right to offend the Prophet when I know that this act will provoke Muslims. I am not against freedom of speech, but this should not offend.
And here, talking with NPR's Eleanor Beardsley, a Muslim man in Paris, explained what he thought about the Charlie Hebdo killings.
I'm not saying what they did was good, replies Hakim Dridi.
But those cartoonists shouldn't have been doing that. They know Muslims are practicing the religion, and they should leave them alone. They provoked it, and they knew it was coming because they had a bodyguard.
So does that mean they deserved it? Everybody sees this can be used, just how yours is, talking with NPR's Morning Edition today, saying Al-Qaeda, basically in competition with ISIS, claiming responsibility as they have now for the Charlie Hebdo killings, gives it an edge it can declare to the world, we have avenged the Prophet.
This tells you a great deal about the strategy behind Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. It would like to convince Muslim public opinion that Al-Qaeda is the vanguard of the Muslim community. Anyone who insults or anyone who attacks the Muslim community, basically Al-Qaeda will try to counterattack.
And with that, look to gain support. We've been joined by Mustafa Akyol. He's author of Islam Without Extremes, A Muslim Case for Liberty, Turkish newspaper columnist joining us, and New York Times joining us today from Washington. With us right now as well from Memphis, Tennessee, is Sheikh Dr. Yasir Qadhi, Dean of Academic Affairs at Al Maghrib Institute. It's an Islamic education institute, a Sunni cleric, got his doctorate in theology at Yale, trained for 10 years at Saudi Arabia's Islamic University of Medina. Sheikh Dr. Yasir Qadhi, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom. It's my pleasure.
So Mustafa, he's a reformer, but he says, look, this is not in the Quran. This is not what the Quran advises. And so let's back off of this very hot temperature about blasphemy. What do you say?
Well, Tom, I think that the issue of blasphemy in the Muslim world is a very important conversation. I strongly believe that in the modern world, Muslims do need to rethink through their tradition. And perhaps this is one of those laws that should be redefined in terms of the modern world. However, I do point out that concentrating on the Islamic laws of blasphemy, especially in the context of today's world and these terrorist attacks, really is a red herring that distracts from the greater problem. The fact of the matter is that each and every terrorist that has claimed to be acting in the name of Islam, from Al-Qaeda to the Boston bombers to the French Kouachi brothers, they always list as their primary motivation a list of political grievances that they seek to avenge. It is my contention, the contention of many people inside the faith and researchers outside of the faith, that were it not for the political grievances that these people and these groups have, insulting the Prophet would only do would enrage them, but it wouldn't lead to terrorism and attacks. Mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda and ISIS and all of these groups, their ultimate goal, their ultimate agenda is to avenge political grievances. They don't hate us for our freedoms. They're not killing us because we're offending the Prophet. They're hating us and they're attacking us because of political grievances that they have with the Western world. And were it not for these political grievances, we wouldn't be seeing these terrorist attacks.
Yes, sir, Hadi, I understand what you mean in any number of things you listed there, but it gets a little tougher for me anyway when you get to the Kouachi brothers, because their attack was explicitly articulated as retribution, vengeance for the depictions of the Prophet that they found, I guess, an insult. What you've just stated isn't true that they have this whole list. It was straightforward, and it was essentially blasphemy, an insult of the sacred.
Actually, that's not correct, because in the final
look at the videotape. They came out.
Exactly. Look at the videotape and look at the final interview that was done with Koulibaly, who was one of the French attackers who was holding the grocery store hostage. When the interviewer asked him that, why are you killing innocent people? What did he say? He said, you're accusing me of killing innocent people when you're the ones who have invaded Afghanistan and Syria and Iraq, and the litany began. Also, I totally agree that one of the motivations is to defend the Prophet. However, the anger that exists in these people is not coming from offending the religion. It comes from decades, years of oppression that they feel a part of the Muslim world. After so many attacks, really, I think it's high time that we take a step back and wonder, why do so many people and groups hate us, especially in the last 15 years? What exactly is going on? And all one needs to do is to look at the rhetoric directly from the bombers themselves, from these hijackers themselves. And again, Koulibaly's interview is online, and you can listen to it, where he very clearly says, I'm not killing civilians. You're the people who basically have attacked. And again, as a Muslim cleric, I say, of course, I disagree. Of course, I believe these are terrorist attacks. However, I don't blame my faith, and I don't blame the Quran. I blame the anger that's coming from these people as having emanated from reactions to political issues.
So I acknowledge this, and you say a little self-examination, dear West, is in order here. Fair enough. What about the very wide application of very severe blasphemy laws inside the Islamic world against Muslims? What's that about?
There's no denying that a lot of these laws are being misused and abused by political regimes, by corrupt potentate governments, frankly, many of which we ourselves support. That also cannot be ignored. There's no denying that traditional Islamic law is misused and abused in a political context. And I'm not intimately familiar with the Saudi bloggers case, but from what I understand, there are political issues at stake here, not primarily religious issues. However, one does need to take a step back and point out that free speech is not something that is a given. It's a disputed concept even within the Western world. Every single society places some limits on the exercise of speech. And there has to be a little bit of cultural sensitivity and cultural relativism here, where we avoid imposing our values on other people. Let me give you a very simple example. Here we are talking about the Islamic world and its imposition of blasphemy laws. We are not talking about the EU, where 16 countries have banned Holocaust denial, and actually people have gone to jail for that. Mm-hmm. We personally might not have those laws in our country, but we don't find those those laws that taboo, i.e. we are somewhat sympathetic to those laws. Additionally,
the French shutting down a comedian there just in the last day or two.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. The French, and how many, so we have Je suis Charlie as a hashtag. We don't have Je suis Didion. I don't know how to pronounce the name. Mm-hmm. Didion is the comedian who was arrested for lampooning the cartoons. We're not supporting that cartoonist. And in fact, he is in jail as we speak. We're not engaging in campaigns to free him. We're not seeing mass protests on the street. So every single society censors its speech, either through the law or through social customs and social backlash. For example, if a company CEO were to use derogatory terms, were to make fun of homosexuals, were to be anti-Semitic, maybe he wouldn't go to jail, but that person could not remain in that position. Look at the president of Harvard, who had to resign when he made a comment that was deemed to be sexist. And the cases go on and on. There is no ultimate freedom of speech anywhere in the world.
Boy, except a lot of people have put a lot of effort into expanding the room for freedom of speech. And even among Muslims, you have people saying, I mean, here's this is Rachel Ghannouchi. This is a movement out of Tunisia saying blasphemy is not a crime. Freedom of choice is very clear in the Quran. It says, let there be no compulsion in religion. Mustafa Akyol, you're listening patiently there. I mean, I wonder where this goes. I accept the idea that the fact that there are political undercurrents under all this. I mean, when are politics and religion ever isolated from one another? But how do we work this out? You're Turkish, Mustafa. Your own prime minister, I'm quoting him here, saying, when it's in the form of a provocation, there should be international legal regulations against attacks on what people deem sacred on religion. He says, freedom of thought and belief ends where the freedom of thought and belief of others start. That is a pretty tight chokehold around freedom of thought.
It is. It is. I mean, I don't agree with the Turkish officials always on these issues. Well, I should say that our guest has a lot of right points. Yes, groups like Al-Qaeda are probably driven more by political grievances than maybe other issues. And the West, therefore, should be careful not to be in this vicious cycle of engaging in aggressive wars on terror and creating more reaction on the other side. So that's a part of the, of course, matter. But I also think it is important for Muslims, for us Muslims, to really to do our job on our side, which is to look our religious concepts in the light of the modern age. Regarding Al-Qaeda, I mean, when they say we are launching jihad, we should say, no, jihad cannot mean attacking innocent civilians, and here is the religious reasoning for that. So we should question that from a religious point of view. And regarding blasphemy, I think, as our guest acknowledged, we should revisit and reinterpret our laws on blasphemy. Rashid Ghannouchi, the scholar you quoted, Tunisia, is actually very important here. He's the leader of the Islamist movement there, but it's the most liberal-leaning, democratic, moderate Islamist movement in the Muslim world and very successful so far.
And it's pointed out that when he said that, blasphemy is not a crime, he didn't say it in Tunisia. He said it in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, well, maybe more so he emphasized in Washington, D.C., but Mr. Ghannouchi has some revisiting on Islamic law, which I think is important because he's a respected Islamic scholar which has valued democracy for a long time. The thing is, of course, the West has a lot of things to correct in its behaviors towards Islam, and we should talk about that. But the Muslim discourse should be criticizing that, but plus also doing some self-critical thinking within the Muslim world ourselves. There are really aspects of Islamic law that do not fit into the modern world. That is blasphemy laws, apostasy laws, or the corporal punishments, and how do we re-understand and reinterpret them is a key matter. And I think Muslim thinkers should really put some thought into that and also challenge the radicals, the extremists, who actually rely on some medieval Islamic texts by offering fresh interpretations.
Mustafa Akyol, please stand by in Washington. Sheikh Dr. Yasir Qadhi in Memphis. More voices in a moment. Callers first. Davian is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Davian, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello also to your esteemed guest.
Thank you.
Listening to you speak, Tom, and you just spoke about something which I found very compelling when you said that when does politics and religion when are they ever very, really far apart?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like as though one of your guests, the esteemed colleague from Memphis, is using a bit of circular logic when he says that they are their primary motivation is political, when, as you just said, the politics are not very far from removed from religion. I think what we have here is, in fact, it is a war of ideology. When we say we're not at war with Muslims, we are, in fact, and speaking, when I say we, I'm speaking just as a personal, as an American here, not, I'm standing outside of it myself and being objective. There is a war between the ideologies there because the two cannot coexist peacefully. I mean, if you look at it, that's just a simple fact of the matter, is that if you are a true believer in Islam or any religion, say the Pope, what he came out and said, if you mm-hmm. are a true believer, mm-hmm. then you must take offense at what is being presented as your religion, because it is the secularists, the outsiders. They are lampooning you. They are, in fact, antagonizing and provoking you.
I mean, offense is one thing, Davian. I take your point, and I'll take it right to Yasser Qadhi here. But surely killing is another thing, or 1,000 lashes for that matter. But people look at this in all different ways. How, Sheikh Dr. Yasser, how do we sort this out? I mean, we had, in the heat of the Charlie Hebdo killings, we had on a correspondent from Le Figaro, conservative French newspaper, but very widely circulated there. And she was saying, look, these, from a French point of view, these are the rights we fought for in our religious wars, in our revolution. These are fundamental to the nation of France. And why should we bow down to a religious view when our modern identity as a nation was born out of rejection of subservience to the clerical?
Well, I mean, a number of points. There's a lot of stuff packed there. Firstly, the notion that one can't be a good Muslim and be an American or a French citizen. I would like to think I'm a good Muslim, and I am a U.S. citizen, and I don't
see
a
contradiction. We're wide open to this, but you hear the question from Davian. Is there a fundamental tension in here of some kind, and how do we resolve it?
Well, the tension is created by extremists of both sides. And again, I go back to the issue of we choose which issues to provoke and which issues are taboo. We are not going to see, for example, in America, cartoonists lampooning the deaths of our soldiers overseas and saying it was a waste of time before.
Oh, I've seen that. I have seen that kind of cartoon.
But it's not going to be on a mainstream cover.
That's not true. Those kind of cartoons have been in the Washington Post and newspapers across this
lampooning
country.
Lampooning the deaths of our soldiers?
Lampooning the futile expenditure of blood.
That's true.
Yes.
Futile wars, yes.
Well, those are soldiers.
There are sacred – well, for example, racist speech, the N-word. There are many things that would not be printed or would not be done in public. And if it were done, they would be socially ostracized. So again, we are choosing which – and again, the French cartoonist that was jailed yesterday, why didn't the minister or why didn't the correspondent of Le Figaro go and defend his freedom of speech? They're really – and one cannot dissociate and ignore the colonialist legacy of France, the ghettoization of the North African Muslim communities for the last 50 years,
fair,
the racism,
fair,
the institutionalized racism.
Fair, but I want to channel our caller for just a moment here and hold you closer to this, because I fear that our caller, Nashville Davian, will still be thinking, but, I mean, Mustafa says you've got medieval elements that the Islam needs to work out here. What if there is a real ideology? How do you square this? If you've got freedom of speech, let's say in France, even or maybe even especially including about religion, and on the other hand, Islam that is still coming with this notion of blasphemy. Yes, there are reasons for it, but there's the thinking. How do you square these? Our caller says there's a war of ideology. Is there?
Look. In the end of the day, the vast majority of Muslims living in the Western world, they might be offended, but they're not going to harm anybody. And I think, you know, the fact that two or three people attacked out of 10 million is enough to indicate that this is not the mainstream perception of the Muslim world. But again, I ask, why is it that freedom of speech really seems to concentrate only on offending one minority? Freedom of speech is not shown to other...
I don't buy that. If you look around at the press, lots of people are mocked and ridiculed and lots of people...
Not to the same level and not to the same dynamics. One cannot
ignore... I saw the cover of Charlie Hebdo with Jesus on the cross being mocked.
But there
is
a there is a difference when the dominant culture is being mocked versus a persecuted minority. Mm-hmm. We don't mock African Americans in this country like... maybe that would have happened 70, 80 years ago because they are a minority that really has different rights than we
True.
Do. We're not mocking Ferguson, the people that were killed at Ferguson, because there are sensitivities that we're not going to cross.
But if they were mocked...
Then nobody should be killed. I think we all agree.
Or flogged or... please stand by. Well, Sheikh Dr. Yasser Qadhi, we have to take a short break here. We'll be right back. Mustafa Akyol, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Islam and blasphemy, beatings in Pakistan, flogging in Saudi Arabia, death in Paris at Charlie Hebdo. It's complicated. Yes, there are a lot of politics flowing through this. But there it is, front and center. Killers at Charlie Hebdo saying we've avenged the prophet. We've been talking with Sheikh Dr. Yasser Hadi. He's Dean of Academic Affairs at the Al-Maghrib Institute, an Islamic Education Institute, joining us today from Memphis, a Sunni cleric. Mustafa Akyol joins us from Washington, columnist for Turkey's Star and Hurriyet Daily News, monthly columnist for the New York Times, author of Islam Without Extremes. Right now we go to London and Clive Stafford Smith. He is director and founder of the British human rights NGO Reprieve. They work around the world on death penalty cases, on torture. Look, it's not just the Islamic world. They work on Guantanamo Bay, drones, secret prisons, but also issues around blasphemy. Currently defending a British citizen in Pakistan, Mohammed Asghar, elderly, mentally ill British citizen who's been sentenced to death for blasphemy. Clive Stafford Smith, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
I'm reading Fareed Zakaria here, writing, he says, Pakistan is now the poster child for the anti-blasphemy campaign gone wild. Lots of incidents there, but not only there, he says, Bangladesh, Malaysia, Egypt, Turkey, Sudan, you can go on in the Muslim world. How widespread is the fierce application of blasphemy law today?
Well, I think Pakistan's a very interesting topic because you want to go back a little in the history to 1927 when the first blasphemy law was brought in there, and it was brought in by the British. And as you may tell, I'm half British and half American, and I apologize for the part that's British on that because—
Why did they do that?
They did it, interestingly enough, because they were trying to get different faiths to get along. And they thought the way to do that was to trample on free speech and to censor people. And they thought that would make things better. And, you know, it's interesting, as you went for the next 60 years, it was basically ignored. There were only 14 reported cases of blasphemy in the next 60 years up until 1986. But then all of this started getting politicized, first by General al-Haq. When in the last 20 years or so, there have been 1,274 people charged with blasphemy.
And that's with legal charges. We read plenty of others. Right. It seems to be just sort of mobs just doing their business.
Well, it's true. It's true. But I think something that Dr. Kadi said is very true also, which is that none of this was really taken seriously until much more recently. All of these people who would be charged with blasphemy back in the 80s and 90s, yeah, they might get convicted of it, but the courts would throw it out on appeal. No one made, you know, much hay out of it. Mm-hmm. More recently, though, I go down to Pakistan quite a lot. And as you suggested, I go there on drones, I go there on Guantanamo Bay, mm-hmm. and I go there on blasphemy. And I think what Dr. Kadi said is absolutely right, which is that our policies on, you know, drones and on Guantanamo have taken away America's platform on which we used to speak about free speech, which we should speak to the British about, by the way, and has opened up an area in which people get terribly upset and where the liberals in Pakistan have been unwilling to fight back. And as a result, this has been growing and growing, and it's way more dangerous. When I go there, I go on marches to Waziristan on drones, and it's the safest thing in the world, except for Pakistani drivers. But then when you start talking about blasphemers, oh my goodness, that's a dangerous thing to go to court and defend a blasphemer. And that's because this has been allowed to get totally out of hand, I'm afraid, in Pakistan.
So here, when we're talking politics, Dr. Khadi says this is politics internationally, but this is domestically as well in these countries. I mean, Mauritania, you've got a blogger sentenced to death by firing squad just last month. You know, apostasy there. And you know, we've got people writing that it's merely an attempt to muzzle anyone who questions a system based on oppression by using religion as an instrument.
Well, of course, that's what we, the British, did. And so we weren't quite as extreme in our punishment. But the problem now is that people aren't responding. So, for example, when my clients get charged with blasphemy in Pakistan, they get sentenced to death and the Pakistan legal system's pretty hopeless at killing them. But then they get killed in jail. I mean, look, there was one of them, Tufail Haider, was hacked to death by a police officer with an axe. One of my clients was shot on death row recently for being a blasphemer. And the guy who then tried to kill Governor Taysir and got away with it, killed him, was Governor Taysir's bodyguard, is in the same prison as my British client and is being feted for fighting the blasphemers.
Celebrated there. Dr. Hadi, we've got also the incident in Saudi Arabia where you've got Raif Badawi. He was online, he was talking about Islam and modernity on his blog, and the next thing you know, he's charged 10 years in prison for insulting Islam, 1,000 lashes, 50 a week for 20 weeks, plus $250,000 fine. His lawyers are saying he was whipped for the first time last Friday. It's coming up again tomorrow. His lawyers are saying he may not survive many more of these. What do you say to that, Dr. Khadi?
Well, I mean, again, I think, as I said earlier, this is a very important conversation that needs to take place amongst liberal reformers, amongst Saudi lawyers, amongst the Saudi people. But what I am worried about is that it feeds into the narrative of us somehow subconsciously painting ourselves as the superior and of them as somehow being barbaric and backwards. And we cannot ignore, once again, who's doing the talking on what platform. I wonder how most Americans would react if on Saudi TV they had an entire show critiquing our broken justice system and the commercialization of our prison facilities. I think many of us, rightly, would be outraged, and but we would tell them, who do you think you are, Saudis, to tell us about and pontificate to us about our justice system?
Well maybe so, but a lot of people talk about that justice system, and when they do, they're not charged with blaspheming Christianity and whipped.
Well, I mean, again, I am more than happy to engage in a conversation within the Muslim world as a cleric to talk about the application of these laws. But I do worry about this type of somewhat perverse pleasure that we get by pointing out the supposed backwardness and the barbarity of other cultures. In the process, we ignore, firstly, the hypocrisy of our own societies, and secondly, the power dynamics and the political and economic policies that our own governments enact against those very societies. I'd like to remind our listeners of Foucault and the symbiotic relationship between knowledge and power. There is a constant stigmatization of the other, in this case the Muslim world, and that stigmatization facilitates our foreign policies and our unjust invasions of those lands. And therefore, I'm very hesitant to just follow the narrative. I too believe there should be reform, but I am conscious of which audience and amongst whom, and of also ignoring our own issues and of our own societies and countries as we talk about reform within the Muslim world.
I'm very open to that nuance in the narrative. I mean, that is why you are here, and I'm very glad you're here. At the same time, I think, you know, this isn't pleasure. I mean, what happened in Paris is not pleasurable. Talking about it isn't pleasure. But we can't be mute or blind. Rebecca in New Haven, Connecticut. Rebecca, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
No.
Hello, Rebecca. You're on.
One moment, please.
Oh, dear. Rebecca's down the street. You know, let me go to bring on Rebecca. Let me go to Austin, Texas for a minute while Rebecca gets back to the phone. Yasser in Austin, Texas. You're on the air, Yasser.
Hi, Tom. I have a question. After the 80s, before the 80s, there was no extremists or Al-Qaeda or anything like that. So we all believe the West trained Osama bin Laden and especially the CIA, and everyone knows that. So,
In Pakistan, around the Afghan, the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, and all that, yeah. So
before that, there was no extremists like this. So it's not Muslims. It's the West who trained Osama bin Laden. So why are you guys blaming us for something you did, and you're just generalizing the problem as Muslims?
You know, yes, sir. I take your point. Let me pick it up, if I may, and take that to Mustafa and use that as a jumping off point, if I may, Mustafa, to ask. I mean, this is an extreme example of saying this is political. You know, West, you actually launched all this extremism. Is there something wrong with talking about this internationally when at the same time we do have all kinds of issues between regions and countries and nations and politics here? And in the West, in no country do we have entirely clean hands by any means, as Dr. Khadi points out.
That's for sure. Tom, here's the thing. It's true that the U.S. supported the mujahideens or jihadists in Afghanistan in the 80s against the Soviet occupation. But it's also true that then after that, they got on their next mission, which was to take down the U.S., and they got out of control. We can point to Western colonial history throughout the Middle East, especially in the past two centuries, to really show that it really made things worse in the Muslim world and created a lot of grievances, sometimes wanted to use one Islamist group against another, and that made things worse. And this is endless. And the West should really criticize itself about all this. But as a Muslim myself, I'm also saying, as Muslims, let's get our act together as well. People like Osama bin Laden say they're launching jihad in the name of Islam. Then as a Muslim, I should say, wait a minute, jihad does not mean attacking civilians according to the Quran and Prophet's example and according to even classical Islamic law. When there is killing for apostasy, I should come out and say, wait a minute, people should not be killed because they leave Islam. It's a freedom of religion. And the ban on apostasy is not in the Quran anyway. Again, it's a part of the Sharia that was in medieval era. It was basically at a time that Muslims thought apostates are enemy soldiers who will join the, will become enemy soldiers. So we need, as Muslims, to get our act together and have certain principles about how to respond to these issues. Then we will be on a higher, more moral higher ground to criticize the West for its colonial history or for its ingoing injustices regard towards Muslim societies.
Let me go back and see if we can get Rebecca in New Haven. Rebecca, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, what's your thought?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Tom. First, I'd like to just analyze the format of this program. If we are talking about Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, then we're only talking about two Muslim countries that aren't representative of all of the Muslim countries.
But so we are not only talking about Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. We're talking about Mauritania. We're talking about Sudan. We're talking about Bangladesh. Right. We're talking about Egypt. We're talking about Malaysia. We're talking about Turkey.
And so the freedom of speech is something that I would say most Muslims would agree with.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that you're putting up this value of freedom of speech in a context where you see so much hypocrisy, where you see that the United States has a relationship with Saudi Arabia,
yes,
who is inculcating these countries with Wahhabism, who is promoting these sorts of understandings of Islam, which has nothing to do with the Prophet. And so when we see this, we feel it as the greatest hypocrisy. And when you interview, you know, mm-hmm, angry men on the street who probably have post-traumatic stress disorder and say that they represent Islam, it just is not fair and it's not honest because it's not representing the majority of Muslims.
I mean, I don't know, Rebecca, if the NBC takes its cameras onto the streets in Paris and talks with three guys about how they feel about what's going on with Charlie Hebdo, I think it's fair to hear what they have to say. Of course, they're not everybody within Islam. And yes, there's hypocrisy in this world aplenty. Let us just meditate on that. And thank you, Rebecca. Stephen in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Stephen, you're on.
Hi. I'm not sure if I am seeing or understanding all of this. One major problem I've had over time, hearing about atrocities considered by or acted on by Muslims around the world, or so-called Muslims around the world, who I don't think are actually pursuing their faith. But in Thailand, and the Philippines, for 20 years, there have been Muslim groups that are attacking, murdering locals because they don't like what's happening to them. They don't like the fact that these countries are not accepting their ways, although they just recently came into these countries in the past 30 or 40 years. Boko Haram or in Sudan, all the countries that Tom has mentioned, in South and more in Asia.
What's your point, Stephen?
Africa. The point is that why aren't there charges being brought up against these people for murdering and massacring and raping and torturing local people, school children?
Boko Haram, ISIS.
Why aren't these actions being persecuted or charged? Why aren't Muslim countries condemning or charging in a legal way these actions?
Stephen, let us take it. Dr. Khadi, what do you say to that? Let's take Boko Haram. Let's take ISIS.
Again, two points. Firstly, I personally do not know of a single Muslim who supports Boko Haram.
Mm.
Every single friend of mine, especially my Nigerian friends, are completely outraged.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, there's this notion that every single Muslim has to dissociate from what other Muslims are doing.
Yep.
But again, there is this double standards because I don't see every Christian or every Caucasian having to dissociate from what fellow Christians or Caucasian does. So I don't need to apologize, mm-hmm, or defend against something something I am not guilty of. I have nothing to do with ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Boko Haram, and it's not my job to apologize for what they do. I will criticize them because I'm a Muslim mm-hmm. who believes that they're doing something wrong, but I'm not going to ignore the socio-political context from within which they're coming from.
Fair enough. Clive Stafford-Smith at Reprieve in London, do you see blasphemy charges being reeled back, or are we still in this kind of growth phase of the application of these, but often by authoritarian governments who use it for control?
Well, look, I think we need to join forces and join hands with reasonable Muslims, who are the vast majority. And first, we need to educate ourselves about Islam, because our argument in Pakistan is if they just applied Islamic law properly, they wouldn't be sentencing any of these people to death. But second, we need to look a little bit at ourselves as well. I mean, when we focus so much on the anger that Muslims have about this sort of provocation, we need to remember our own responses to flag burning or to abortion clinics where we kill people there. And we need to celebrate the fact that we view free speech as such an important act. And then we need to look around at our other policies, which have effectively provoked a lot of people and given them anger against America, such as Guantanamo, such as drones, such as Abu Ghraib. And we need to try to live up to our own high standards so we give people something to admire instead of get angry at.
Room for reflection on all sides here, but I think I come out of this with a little better understanding of how blasphemy sits in the Islamic world, in Islamic scripture, and in the fraught politics of our world today. I want to thank all three of you for helping us do that. Mustafa Akyol, author of Islam Without Extremes, thank you for joining us today, Mustafa.
My pleasure, Tom.
Sheikh Dr. Yasser Hadi at Al Maghrib Institute, joining us from Memphis. Thank you, Dr. Hadi.
Pleasure was mine. Thank you very much.
And Clive Stafford-Smith at the NGO, the British human rights organization Reprieve, joining us from London. Thank you, Clive.
Thank you, and thank you to your guests.
And to all of our callers. Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.